really struck me about this war is that Schwarzkopf, in my judgment, within the military organizations that I've been, seems to have been admired as much for that briefing that stands out in your mind,
yeah,
the Hail Mary briefing, as for the operational plan itself.
Propaganda and the Press, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations featuring John MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, and Donald Shaw of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. In his new book about the war in the Persian Gulf, John MacArthur argues that the American press failed to be sufficiently critical in its response to stories of Iraqi atrocities in occupied Kuwait. MacArthur's book is entitled Second Front and subtitled Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War. It describes an inflamed climate of opinion at a time surrounding many crucial decisions about American military involvement in the Middle East. Second Front also criticizes the American press for coverage that, in MacArthur's view, amounted more to public relations than hard-nosed journalism. Because the issues in his book are fundamental to informed decision-making in a democracy, I asked John MacArthur to describe his argument about how the press went wrong in the Persian Gulf.
To begin with, the press in this country tends to follow the lead of politicians, and the reward system in the media these days is for going along, getting along, staying in the middle, staying with the pack. In my book, I quote Dan Rather at length on this subject, where Rather says, in the old days when he was coming up in the news business, you got rewarded for asking a tough question to a politician. Mm-hmm. You were invited into the club with the real big-time reporters like Murrow and so on and so forth. And he says, nowadays, suck-up journalism is in.
Fair enough. We'll come back to some of these points. Let's get to Second Front. A couple of very strong words here, censorship and propaganda. Tell me about the testimony of a 15-year-old child, a young woman who talked to the Congress of the United States.
Okay. On October 10th, 1990, Hill and Knowlton, a big public relations firm, and the Kuwaiti government, in concert with the Congressional Human Rights Caucus, pulled off one of the great propaganda coups of the last 50 years.
And you're using this word unapologetically.
Oh, yes.
Propaganda.
I mean, and I think they would, too, if they were speaking honestly. They'd say, my God, we pulled off a terrific propaganda coup. And they had a young woman named, identified only as Naira, a Kuwaiti refugee, 15 years old, tell the caucus and the whole world that she had witnessed Iraqi soldiers removing babies from incubators in a Kuwait City hospital where she claimed she was working as a volunteer during the occupation, and left them, the babies, on the cold floor to die.
All right, now this was responsible for a lot of the support that got generated.
I believe so.
Uh-huh.
I think that this was absolutely critical in terms of convincing Americans that Saddam Hussein really was the reincarnation of Adolf Hitler.
Does it matter that this did or did not happen? I mean, what is to the point here, Rick, as we discuss the rationale for America's involvement, participation in the Gulf War?
Well, what's important is that it almost certainly did not happen. There is not one shred of evidence that any Iraqi took any babies out of any incubators any time during the occupation. There is lots and lots of evidence that the Kuwaitis made the story up.
Well, let's get to the coverage of the war itself.
And of course, the point is that Naira was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. She was not just some refugee who showed up in Washington to testify. She was a what I think criminal defense lawyers would call a safe witness.
And your argument is that this happened in complicity with Mr. Lantos, who was the head of the...
Yes, Mr. Lantos was in bed with the Hill and Knowlton executives. He's taken money from Hill and Knowlton for his campaigns. His Congressional Human Rights Foundation got $50,000 from the Citizens for a Free Kuwait not long after the hearing was held. That's the way Washington works.
Well, let's get to the coverage of the war itself. Aside from these very serious charges about propaganda and getting the American people, the American military involved, again, the press, your argument is just rolled over and went over there and said we're going to tell the people what you, the military, tell us to tell them.
Pretty much, some reporters and some editors objected, but by and large, the media went over to tell the government story, and they continued to tell the government story from the day the first bomb dropped till the day the war ended.
This was a monolithic voice. There was no reservation whatsoever.
Well, there was some reservation. I mean, it was, but it wasn't very enthusiastic. The media caved in to the government's wishes in terms of press pools and censorship.
Is that unprecedented?
In the fall.
Has that ever happened before like that?
Well, it was never an issue before in the sense that it was this time. In Vietnam, there was no censorship. Reporters could pretty much go anywhere they wanted. Mm-hmm. And people generally agree that the Vietnam War was the best reported war we've ever had. And reporters were certainly expecting censorship of some kind because of Grenada and Panama.
Right.
The genesis of this is really the Falklands War, where the British very effectively manipulated, controlled coverage of the Falklands War.
That's what
Falklands
you call the model.
That's the model that the American government followed in Grenada and then Panama.
Uh-huh.
Well, certainly in Panama, where they invented the pool system. In Grenada, they didn't even tell the press corps they were invading. Then in Panama, after people had complained, they set up these press pools to control access to the theater of battle, and of course didn't tell anybody, made sure that the pools arrived late so that nobody saw anything. And then the same thing happened in the Gulf War.
Let's step back from the particulars of the coverage and talk about rationale here. Earlier in a meeting here at the Humanities Center, one of the people at this seminar mentioned something about Vietnam and how we were, in effect, the media in covering the Gulf War was helping the American people to achieve not, how did he put it, not democracy, but victory, and healing a wound. Now, talk to me for a moment about the lesser of two evils here as we seek such closure for national problems like that?
Well, I think it's sad if the American people feel they need to squash a third world army and kill 30 or 40,000 people, including 3,000 or so civilians, in order to exorcise their hurt feelings about losing the war in Vietnam. However, I think it's an oversimplification to say that Americans in general were trying to do that. I think there was a bandwagon effect after the war ended. Before the war started,
50-50.
It was 50-50. The country was divided. And if you remember, there were some very eloquent speeches in the Senate by anti-war senators saying, let's not get conned again. Let's not repeat the mistakes of Vietnam. Let's not believe without questioning everything the White House tells us about
the
circumstances.
And yet, in order to close that wound, we succumbed to that logic, nonetheless.
Well, I'm not sure. I think the baby incubator fraud and the atrocities exaggerations had more to do with convincing Americans to go to war by a bare majority than Vietnam did.
What kinds of conditions do we need to strive for or create so that the press doesn't get sucker punched again?
Well, I'm afraid it's up to the publishers, the owners. A.J. Liebling pointed out that freedom of the press is guaranteed only to those who own one. And Americans don't, by and large, own newspapers or radio stations or television networks, and neither do reporters.
Do you think that the people really care about public events in the sense that well, to put it bluntly, my sense is that they've been conditioned, as it were, to accept this kind of reporting, and the newspapers, the TV networks look at them and they say, well, we give you what you want, and we give you the truth, and people buy that.
Well, I think, sure, some people are gullible, some people will believe anything they're told by an anchor man, but I think the American people get sold short. They're smarter than politicians or the media give them credit for, and that they're much more skeptical than people realize. And I keep coming back to this 50-50 number. Don't forget that half the country was opposed to going to war to restore the Emir of Kuwait on January 12th when the Senate debate started. It was even with all the propaganda and all the urging of the White House and Helen Knowlton and the Kuwaitis and the help of the media in promoting the Kuwaiti cause, there were still enough skeptical people to nearly prevent the war from starting. Had the Senate vote gone the other way, it was only really, it was a 5-vote majority for war, and it really would have been 4 votes if Cranston had voted, we would have had a constitutional confrontation.
Well, that's a topic for another radio program. Let's move toward a conclusion of this part of our conversation, Rick. Let me put it to you this way. You're a journalist, and yet you think of yourself as an amateur historian. Aren't we really too close to the events to make judgments like this? I mean, don't we need the dispassion of distance to figure out what really happened there?
To some extent, yes. I mean, the best history of the Gulf War is yet to be written. I'm not pretending mine is it. And it will be written, I'm sure, someday. But in the meantime, we have to face what facts and learn what facts we can. And we should have learned a lot of the facts that I have in my book before the war started. The exaggerated atrocities, the exaggeration of the number of Iraqi troops.
Well, now let me stop you. Regardless of how reliable or unreliable the figures are, what you're doing is assuming an enormous amount of intellectual acumen and curiosity on the part of the people that just isn't there. And in a way, we're not talking about the press here. We're talking about our educational system, all the assumptions that drive the interplay between culture and politics in this society.
Yeah, I agree with you completely that you can't ask the media to educate the American public. First of all, they're not going to.
Yeah.
But even if they wanted to, they couldn't do the job entirely by themselves. Americans are famously ignorant of geography. I'm sure 90% of Americans that we would find couldn't have found Kuwait on the map when Bush suddenly decided it was the most important place in the world. And that's dangerous, that Americans don't know geography. It's also dangerous, though, that they don't understand the way the media works and that they're not more skeptical of the way the well, some people are, but that they don't get more information on their own. A lot of what's in my book and that wasn't reported during the months that preceded the war could have been discovered from other sources. But you have to know where to look, and that takes education and skills that most people don't have.
Here's a final question about your book, Second Front, Rick MacArthur. In the South, we have an expression, it's my dog and I'll kick it. Aren't you being really awfully arrogant, and aren't you betraying your tribe here by writing a book like this?
Boy, I wonder sometimes whether we're members of the same tribe anymore. When I came into the newspaper business, I used to be a reporter and an editor. I was inspired by Woodward and Bernstein and the exposés of Vietnam by Seymour Hersh, Harrison Salisbury. These were our heroes. Today, the heroes of the young journalist are Arthur Kent, people who don't really do reporting.
Well,
just
I'm sure
look
he's
good
a,
on television.
I'm sure he's a good guy and he loves his mom, but it's mainly appearance. That's your point.
It's appearance and who gets ahead. And if you look at who gets ahead in the news business these days, you see that the glib courtier gets ahead faster than the serious reporter. The serious reporter ends up getting fired or quitting out of frustration and going to work as a freelancer, writing books, or if they can't make a living, they go into public relations.
Rick MacArthur, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are the publisher of Harper's Magazine. Your book is Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War. It's available from Hill and Wang. Thanks for coming by. Good luck in your work.
Thank you, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Censorship, propaganda, and the press. Join me now for a conversation with Donald Shaw, a professor of journalism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. According to Donald Shaw, a clash of historical models underscored American reporting about the Persian Gulf War. The president expected support from the Congress, the press, and the public. Reporters expected freedom to roam the battlefield. The military expected containment of news that might help the enemy. When hostilities ceased, the president and the military claimed victory despite grumbling from the press. Donald Shaw observed the conflict in the Gulf not only from the standpoint of a journalism professor, but from the perspective of the Army's Office of Chief of Public Affairs, from which he recently retired as a reserve officer. Referring to one of his forthcoming publications, I asked Donald Shaw to describe the three phases of reporting that he argues are characteristic of the interplay between the military and the press.
Thank you. My student and I have been doing some research using the Persian Gulf War and comparing it with Vietnam, and we conclude that reporters seem to go through about three phases. The first phase is they simply take the comments of military authorities as fact because they have little other alternative to do so. But the second phase is, after time passes, they develop their own sources, and they begin to have different perspectives on the same facts, but their editors are often dubious about these new stories coming in. And the third phase is the editors and the reporters begin to agree, and so genuine diversity in reporting services. That seems to have happened in Vietnam clearly, and we think, in a way, it's still going on in the Persian Gulf because we think of reporting like a windshield wiper. Even though the war may be over, like you turning off your windshield wiper,
right,
it keeps doing a few swipes until it's all cleared off.
All right, well, now let's reflect on what we've just heard from Rick MacArthur of Harper's Magazine. He's got some pretty tough things to say about the Bush administration, about the way the press was massaged, manipulated, handled. How do you react to this, Don?
Well, I think the press did the very best job it could in the first days of the war. I happened to have been there on active duty the day the air war started.
Yeah, we should
insert
here parenthetically that you wore two hats. I mean, here you are not only a professor of journalism, but you were, at the time that the war broke out, a public affairs officer.
That's correct. Working in the Department of the Army in the Pentagon. So I was there that first night that Cheney and Powell came for the press conference after the air war began. And it was a highly technical war. It was a war in which there were few people on the ground, so they necessarily had to depend on those briefings, and they did a good job.
Well,
let me
stop you. Did the administration hornswoggle the press? I mean, did they in effect censor this the brief coverage that we had of the war?
Yes, I think they did. They kept pretty good control in the early days because simply there were almost no alternative routes to get information except through the Pentagon. And
right. Now, wait, you're telling me that's a justifiable thing to do, in other words?
Well, I'm saying that if I were a military officer in the White House in the very earliest days of a war, I probably would want to control it in those days. I surely would. I would not want them to know precisely when my ground action would start and where it would start or when my air actions, where they would be and so on.
Where do we draw the divide line between the freedom of the press and the you know, this icon that we have in our society of the public's right to know and the security of the people who are involved in the war? How do we figure out that
tension? Well, historically, that's always been a challenge all the way back to the Civil War and even before that, and the press generally agrees that they should not reveal when and where a specific action is going to occur.
Mm-hmm.
But the question you ask is divided up in my mind in this way. Is that the military is in a position to tell you what, when, where, and within reason without giving away anything. But the White House is in a position to tell you why things occurred.
Mm-hmm.
That is what the military strategy is. In my judgment, the press at first concentrates on the who, what, when, and where, and the hows and the whys come later. And there was very little of that in the early days, very little of the why we're in this war, other than to free Kuwait.
Give me a sense, Don Shaw, of the perils and rewards, the criticism and the praise from both the left and the right of the way the press behaved or was managed in the Gulf War.
Well, I think it'll start from the right. In my judgment, those people who were critical of the press take the point of view that the end justifies the means, and they have a lot of faith in the authority to do the right thing. In a way, that's the way I divide conservatives and liberals, sort of. I mean, in your trust in the people higher up. And so, therefore, when the press was pretty much following the Pentagon line without much question, I think they agree with that. But any of the other kind of diversity in reporting, such as in Phase 2 or Phase 3, are bound to irritate that group.
Mm-hmm.
From the left side, they want more whys and hows addressed as early as possible, and that's the difference. I mean, if you're a military officer, your point of view is that you want support, you want public support, you want military support, you don't want anything to affect the morale of your troops. From the White House, their perspective is different. They want public support too, but they're more concerned about long-range strategic options. And the public wants to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
They want to support troops. They want to support the president and so on. And sometimes it's quite confusing in the mix.
Don, comment for me on Rick MacArthur's charge that the war, in effect, was sold to the Congress inappropriately, illegitimately, the testimony of the young Kuwaiti woman before Congressman Lantos's committee.
Well, I agree with him. It was outrageous, and a number of congressmen found it outrageous, too, since they didn't realize that the young woman speaking was the daughter of the ambassador, and that was part of a sheer manipulation, and I regard that as quite unfair. But it's not something the military had anything to do with. In terms, they knew nothing about it any more than the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I think the assumption is sometimes that the perspective of the White House and the perspective of the military is the same. They're not. They're not the same perspective. The perspectives of the military are much more limited and focused, and they want to accomplish the job in a sensible fashion, whereas the White House is interested in broader public support and so on. And I think that in the Persian Gulf War, in a way, the White House did not do an adequate job of addressing the whys. Indeed, mm-hmm. at first they talked about eliminating the Iraqis from Kuwait, and then they added to or implied that maybe we should eliminate Hussein from office, and then they implied, well, perhaps we should eliminate his nuclear capability, and then they implied that the White House did that perhaps the Kurds should revolt, and then so forth and so on. So you say
the war is going on. I mean, this is the windshield wiper.
In a way, it still
effect.
Is. Yeah, I think the windshield wiper is still going on, and in fact, may be a problem for President Bush today, because much of the early feeling of victory that many people had has been tarnished. Saddam Hussein is still very much in power, indeed may be stronger. It's a little bit unclear yet what will happen to his nuclear capability. He's retooling his forces. The Kurds are in bad shape,
uh-huh.
and threatening the whole region. The political arrangement with the Israelis and so on is still very much in the air. We've discovered that many of our weapons that were lauded were in fact poor performers and so on.
Give me a historical sense, Don Shaw. Let's step back a little bit from the immediate circumstances of the Persian Gulf War. You began your comments here for Soundings talking about Vietnam, and again, I'm referring back to this portion of the program we heard with Rick MacArthur. In the Persian Gulf, we had a healing, we had a victory that we didn't experience in Vietnam. What about that?
Well, I think it's a feeling in the military that they, in this war, they got the kind of support they didn't have in the last war. The wars are really quite different. One stretched over almost a decade, and this one stretched over weeks, even hours on the ground. And when the troops came home to victory, and they felt great about that. Indeed, there are some still over, but most have come home. And so it was as if this time, in the minds of some, that the public righted what it had in the minds of some wronged before in terms of support.
Don, where are your loyalties? Again, you are both a professor of journalism, you have been active in the military, you have seen this Persian Gulf War from the perspective of both somebody who teaches all of our noble goals of journalism, objectivity and all of that, and yet you have been a participant in the war itself. Where do you land on this issue?
I don't think I have to choose sides. I think I can be a very loyal Army officer and also loyal to the concept of truth and so on. So I don't really take sides. And I believe that most information officers would say just what I'm saying now, that it's the policy would be to deliver what you can. And the military did that. The who's, the what's, the when's, and the where's. And after it was over, even the how's they did it.
Uh-huh.
The why's, why it was done, that's really a White House problem, so to speak. And the White House, in my judgment, could have done somewhat better than that. Indeed, they're still wrestling with that question.
Here's a footnote to our conversation, Don Shaw. The Pentagon has just agreed with the press, as it were, two establishments here, on a new set of rules governing the reporting of war. That is to say, openness, we're going to minimize the pool coverage, we're going to allow for more independence. Do you think that these are the right steps that are being taken at the right time?
Yes, because the job of a reporter is to present facts and perspectives, and in the Persian Gulf Phase 1, the earliest days of the war, and this very short war, the perspectives they presented were primarily those of high levels and technical perspectives of how equipment functioned. You do not get, or did not at first get, perspectives of ordinary soldiers. There were substantial numbers of women. 20% of the forces were women there. What about the naval forces? We got primarily a kind of a control perspective. If you read widely, you'd see that the French had a perspective on that war different from us. The British had one different from us. The Soviets had one different from us. And that began to, if you read widely enough, you'll see those perspectives. But that needs to be released. Reporters need to be able to roam freely for perspectives. I'm not talking about facts here. Mm-hmm. I'm just talking about the same facts seen differently.
All right. And perspective, a final footnote here. Perspective, this is, we don't get to the truth of these things until a lot of time passes. Is that basically what we should understand about war coverage?
Yes. I think that was true in Vietnam. It's been true in other wars as well. I think the three phases of reporting we're talking about occur and have occurred in all the wars we've looked at. We've looked somewhat at World War II, somewhat at Korea, a lot at Vietnam, and now the Persian Gulf. Mm-hmm. The last wars have been too fast to get much of a perspective on it, except the windshield wiper still seems to work in, for example, the war in the Panama and the Grenada. And some of the stuff that's come out from each of those wars, especially with Panama, is not altogether favorable to us in terms of casualties and so on. But some facts are still coming out, and it makes you wonder if it shouldn't have been released earlier.
Don Shaw, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are a senior fellow at the Freedom Forum Media Studies Center up in New York. You're also a Keenan Professor of Journalism at UNC Chapel Hill. Thanks for coming by, and good luck in your work.
Thank you.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to conversations about censorship, propaganda, and the press. My guests were John R. MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, and Donald Shaw, senior fellow at the Freedom Forum Media Studies Center and Keenan Professor of Journalism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This program is available on cassette. Please send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 620. That's program number 620, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, the first of two programs on biotechnology and social ethics. Listen for scholars, scientists, and writers from the University of California, Harvard University, the National Institutes of Health, and Institutional Investor magazine. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Censorship, Propaganda, and the Press. This week on Soundings, I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. From the Civil War to Desert Storm, listen for John MacArthur, the publisher of Harper's Magazine, and Donald Shaw of the Freedom Forum Media Studies Center. Censorship, Propaganda, and the Press. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.